Right, brethren, last week we began a new, I won't say short series, because the book of Isaiah is unlikely to be a short series, but we're off and running, and you'll recollect we said last week that Isaiah is one of the major prophets in more ways than one. He prophesied for approximately 60 years. That's far as we can make out. That's a pretty long time, from about 740 BC down to about 680 BC, which was a very interesting time to be alive, not perhaps a very pleasant time to be alive. It was a time of war, of invasion, of captivity. In the early part of that period, the house of Israel went into captivity to the Assyrians. That took a number of decades to completely remove all the people. And then a few decades later, after Isaiah's time, the southern house of Judah went into captivity to Babylon. So they were interesting periods in Israel's history. Isaiah himself, his book is, if you recollect, 66 chapters long, which curiously, there are 66 books in the Bible. The book of Isaiah, we said, is the most quoted book in the New Testament, apart from the book of Psalms. Isaiah is quoted 71 times in the New Testament, all the way from Matthew right down to Revelation. So the New Testament writers, the Matthews and Marks and Lukes and Johns and Pauls and so on, they all thought Isaiah was quite important because they often dipped into it and they quoted from it. We said also last week that there are probably, lots of themes, but probably four main themes you can identify going through the book of Isaiah. One is a theme of God's holiness. He is the Holy One of Israel, very holy, and needs to be properly respected for his holiness. A second theme you can see is there are benefits and blessings to those individuals who choose to live God's way, and that hopefully might be you and me. Thirdly, there's a theme of God's justice and judgment. You know, God has to deal with iniquity and wickedness. He is long-suffering. He does wait. He does give many opportunities for people to hear and respond. But as we'll see to the people of Isaiah's day, eventually judgment must come. And that will apply equally in our day. And fourth theme is that Isaiah says a great deal about the coming Messiah, both his first coming and his second coming. Okay, let's open our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 1. We'll just read a couple of verses per chapter to pick up where we were last week. Isaiah chapter 1, if we read verses 2, 3, and 4, we get the first strong indication of the problems. Verse 2 of Isaiah 1, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me." This is God talking to his people. You could apply that, of course, spiritually, if you wish. "The ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider or understand. Alas, sinful nation, a people laden or burdened down with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corrupters. Why? They have forsaken the Eternal. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward." And he continues for many more verses, but Israel, meaning the house of Israel in the north, and in particular here the house of Judah, which is where Isaiah actually was, it was a nation which had forsaken its God. It's a creator, it's provider. They were a wicked and adulterous generation. And I think we said last week, although in intervening centuries technology may have advanced, we have mobile phones and DVD players and aeroplanes, but human nature today is pretty much as it was in Isaiah's day. And we today, you know, the very blessed peoples of America, the UK, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, we're very, very blessed, but also we are a sinful nation. Absolutely. We're a people who are laden with iniquity. And you know, God's no respecter of persons. If we move to chapter 2, and we read verses 2 and 3, here's one of these, I guess you'd call it a prophetic jump, you know, way into the future, because it's even now, still future. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, meaning God's kingdom. God's government will be above all kingdoms and governments. It says that all nations in this latter time shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths." And that hasn't happened yet. "For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem." So we're talking there about a time yet future when no longer will Israel be a sinful nation laden with iniquity. But in these days, the whole world will come to God and say, "We'd like to find out your ways. We've come to realize that your ways are better ways. They lead to good things, prosperity and good health and well-being. Please teach us your ways." But that's yet some way off. Between now and then, things are going to get rather grim. If you look at verse 10 of this same chapter, because much of Isaiah is talking about the correction, the judgment that would come, verse 10, "Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Eternal and the glory of his majesty. The lofty or arrogant looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day." There is coming a time referred to in that day, and that expression occurs many, many times in Isaiah, but in that day, it says here, men will try to hide in the caves and in the rocks. And we saw last week that appears in the book of Revelation, sixth seal, yet to happen. Verse 12, "For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low." So in that day, in its fulfillment, is yet future, when arrogance and the pride of man will be brought down low. Look at verse 21. It talks of the men going into the clefts of the rocks, into the crags of the rugged rocks, from the terror of the Eternal and the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake the earth mightily, just like shaking a rag. The earth's going to be shake, and that elsewhere appears to indicate earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, tidal waves. God is going to shake the earth mightily, and including the structures on it, the cities and so on. That's going to happen. Yet future. If we look at chapter 3, and what we're doing is dipping into a couple of three verses, just a quick reminder. Chapter 3, we read about God would take away all the wise men and the mighty men and the experts. And verse 4 of chapter 3, he will replace them. It says, "I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them." Probably implying just immature, inexperienced individuals, completely lacking any common sense or wisdom. Verse 5, "The people will be oppressed, everyone by another, everyone by his neighbor. The child will be insolent toward the elder, and the base person toward the honorable." Well, probably that's largely talking about hopelessly inexperienced leaders who just made one stupid mistake after another. But obviously, I think looking around our countries, we can see that children today very often are just insolent, literally, toward their elders. There's very little in the way of courtesy and politeness and respect. One of the issues of today. Dropping down to verse 10, despite all these problems, it does say, verse 10, "Say to the righteous," if there are any, "say to the righteous that it shall be well with them." So even though there's great trouble coming, and men, hiding in the rocks and so on, And you know, later on it tells us of great destruction and devastation and famine and who knows what. It says, say to the righteous person, it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. These are good people. These are righteous people. These are people who depend upon their God. And the benefit and the blessing to those individuals is they'll be looked after. But, verse 11, woe to the wicked. It shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hands shall be given him. You know, you reap what you sow. You sow to the flesh, you will of the flesh reap destruction. And they will. On the other hand, if you sow to the Spirit, like the righteous person, you will reap of the Spirit ultimately everlasting life. So there are, you know, hints here and there that those who are seeking to go God's way and living God's way and who are upright in heart, you know, they will be okay. It will go well with them even in the midst of great destruction. Chapter 4, if we turn there, just read verse 2 and 4. It says, in that day, again it seems to be leaping to the yet future, the branch, capital B, of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious. We saw last week the branch is the Messiah, Jesus Christ the Lord. In verse 4, and this will take place when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. And at the moment, the daughters of Zion, Ohola and Oholiba, as we saw last week, basically Israel and Judah, those are the two daughters, are pretty filthy. But someday in the future, they will be cleansed. Okay, let's turn now to chapter 5. And we had started here, but we can start again at verse 1. Just read on pretty rapidly. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. So here's a song. I mean, Isaiah appears to be a very colourful character. He has lots of super-duper word pictures, like the whole nation being like a sick body and chronic from head to toe and so on, all wounds which are filled with pus and hadn't been sort of bound up and so on. He also apparently bursts into song as well. So he's actually put together a little song about the nation. Must have been quite a character. And it's worth remembering that the prophets of old, such as Isaiah, were quite well-known personalities. Isaiah appears to have been quite close to the royal court in Jerusalem, had easy access, fairly easy access at least, to the kings, and well-known to the public at large. He was the official prophet. He may not have been particularly well-liked by the kings at times, and of course the people generally would have rejected his message, but he'd have been known. This is Isaiah the prophet, and he has a certain amount of ability to move around royal circles. But here it goes anyway. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. Sounds good. He dug it up and cleared out its stones, which obviously you'd want to do, get it nice and ready for its planting, and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst, also made a wine press in it, so he expected it to bring forth good grapes. And we're talking here, of course, about the Lord God and his vineyard, and Almighty God considered that he's done quite a lot here. He's prepared this nation very carefully. He's done everything he could possibly do to it. He's expecting some pretty good fruit, some good output, some good produce. But, unfortunately, it brought forth wild grapes, stinky grapes, toxic grapes, not what he was looking for. And what was the problem? Had God not done enough? Was he the problem? Well, verse 3, and now, this is still a song, I guess, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? This is God talking now. Why then, when I expected to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? So God says, what more could I have done? Have I been at fault? Did I not look after these people properly? Did I not bring them out of Egypt? Did I not give them a land flowing with milk and honey? Have I not given them my word and my prophets? What more could I have done And he says in verse 5, "Now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, its protection, and it shall be burned." That's destroyed. Is he talking about a physical vineyard with some vines in there? No, he's not. He's talking about the nation. "I'll break down its wall. It shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste." This is the nation of Israel. "It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. And I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant." So he's talking really, I've been singing about the people. And it says here, he looked for justice. This was the good grapes, justice. But he got oppression, wild grapes. Looked for righteousness, good grapes. But behold, he received weeping. Bad grapes, toxic grapes. And God's disappointed. He expected more from his vineyard. Now, so not to take too much time up, we won't turn to John 15, but you may recollect about, Jesus said he is the vine, his father is the vine dresser, he tends and prunes the vine that brings forth, more fruit, and you and I are that, those individuals in the vine. We have to bring forth much fruit to please the Father. So you're using a vine and a vineyard, they're pictures that God has used throughout history. And you and I, hopefully, should be people that bring forth good fruit, good grapes. Because clearly, God expects to see his vineyard bringing forth good grapes. I guess you can say in your life, what's your fruit like? What do I see in my life? What is my output? What's my produce? What am I bringing into my life for God? Good grapes or wild grapes? That would be an analogy we could look at, but we're focusing more here on the actual words of Isaiah, and he's talking about really the people of Israel and the people of Judah have disappointed God big time. He's done so much for them, he's seeing nothing worthwhile in return. And at verse 8 we begin six woes. And the six of them, we'll get there bit by bit. I managed to highlight them in yellow in my Bible. Number one, it starts in verse 8, "Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land." This is a woe addressed to greedy people, covetous people. And God doesn't like covetousness. It's one of the big ten. Don't covet. Don't covet. But here's people who are greedy and covetous. This is the nation as a whole. This is like people who just accumulate, property and houses, more and more and more, till eventually there's nowhere for some other people to live, virtually. They just acquired everything in sight, taking and getting and acquiring and lusting and coveting, greedy. "In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly, many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones, without inhabitant." So they may have beautiful homes, one day they'll be empty and destroyed. "For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah." Don't mean much to me, not being an agricultural person, but apparently those are one-tenth of what you'd expect. So the land that these people have greedily acquired, is a shortfall of 90% in production. It's a woe, it's a curse. And then verse 11, another woe, the second woe. "Woe, or cursed be those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue till night, till wine inflames them. The harp, the strings, the tambourine, the flute, and wine are in their feasts, their banquets. But they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands." These people, it's a woe to those who are drunken or engaged in self-indulgence. This is people who are utterly selfish. Me, 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 I'm going to have a good time. I'm a party animal. Don't care about God or his ways or his law. I'm just going to eat, drink, and be merry. So a woe, a curse to those who are drunk and self-indulgent, thinking only of myself and my entertainment, and don't regard God's work, don't consider what he's doing. couldn't care less about God. And you can see why, you know, God was not very happy. Continuing, therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge, no understanding. Their honorable men are famished, their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. You know, the grave, so to speak, never satisfied. People can die and die and die and die, and still plenty of room for more people to die. It says their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it, into the grave. People shall be brought down, each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. You know, death, it says, is a great leveler. These people who are self-indulgent and engaged in drink and couldn't care less about God's ways, they'll die, either at the end of their natural lives or, more likely this time in Isaiah's prophecy, from invasion and captivity. But, although they'll be humbled, the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste place of the fat ones strangers shall eat. Now another woe. This is woe number three now. Woe to those who call evil good, and good evil, who put darkness for light, and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. This is woe to those who pervert morality. I read the paper. Actually, I'm not sure that's a great idea. Somebody mentioned Mark Twain this week, and at least I think it was Mark Twain, and he said something like, if you don't read the newspaper, you'll be uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you'll be misinformed. And either way, it doesn't seem like much benefit from reading the paper. But when you read the paper, you'll find out just how much people call good things evil, and evil things good. Apparently, homosexuality is good. Good, proper. Let's teach it to children at school, age 5 and 6 and 7. And anybody who wants to stand up and say that homosexuality is evil, that person's they're filled with hate. They are discriminating. That is a vile thing to actually say that it's a sin and an abomination. Oh, what a horrible, unkind person you are. Well, God says woe to those who pervert morality. Verse 21 is, what's this, number 4 is it, or 5? 1, 2, 3, 4, this is number 5. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. This is woe to those who are vain and conceited, who are intellectually proud. Wise in your own eyes? Mm-mm. God who's lived forever knows a thing or two. People who've lived for 30 years, 50 years, 150 years know squat diddly, and yet think they're so super smart and smarter than God. God says, whoa, cursed, if you're going to be wise in your own eyes, because really, you know, you are a big bozo. And then 22, I guess it's the last one. Woe to men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink. Well, it looks like drink's back here again. But in the connection of who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. This is talking about political corruption. And corruption and judgment in the courts and so on. And let's face it, that happens. There's plenty of deals made in the back rooms by politicians. They're going to trade all sorts of favors. Well, if you sort of provide a bit more money for my state, then I'll vote to get your particular topic through. And so it's all bribes, things of that nature. And probably also lots of wine, alcohol, women, cigars, who knows. And God said, woe to those who are mighty at drinking wine, who justify the wicked and take away justice from the man who deserves it. Therefore, here comes the problems, here comes the punishment. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be rottenness, and their blossom will ascend like dust, because they have rejected the law of the Eternal of Hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. It's not that they didn't have it, they had it but rejected it. Hosea says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And of course, you could see in there a little hint of a warning to you and me. Would it be wise of us to reject the law of the Lord of Hosts or despise his word? Well, no. But I wonder how much we do love the law of the Lord, how much time we spend in his word. Do we have a positive attraction for his law and his word, so that it's important to us and a priority to us? Some of the nation doesn't. Didn't in Isaiah's day, and it says, therefore, the anger of the Eternal is aroused against his people. And these were his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. You know, punishment, but more to come. Verse 26, he will lift up a banner to the nations from afar, and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. You know, lifting up a banner is like, you know, a big sign, a big signal, a big flag up in the air, and then whistling, come on, like, you know, you see your dog sometimes out running around a field, and you want the dog to come, you'll whistle out. That sort of stuff. Can't do that over the phone, I suppose, but you know what I mean. You tend to whistle your dog, and the dog looks up and sees you over there, and half the time turns around and goes the other way. But if it's a well-behaved dog, he says, oh, it wants me, master wants me, and it'll come running across. Well, here God says, you know, he will lift up a banner, a big sign, so the whole world can look across and see it, and he'll whistle to them, come on, come on, over here, this way, this way. And surely they will come with speed swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep. Nor will the belt of their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. This is the enemy. Later years would be Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, and so on. And in our day today, other nations, whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves will seem like flint, their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. This is invasion. This is captivity. This is coming on the house of Israel, and latterly the house of Judah, and of course, prophetically, it will come on God's people today. In that day, I say God's people, I mean the nations of Israel, in the main. In that day, verse 30, they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea, and if one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. And we know the day of the Lord will be a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of trouble and distress, a day of the alarm and the trumpet, and it will be a very dark day, I guess spiritually as well. Go to chapter 6. In the year that, this is really actually strange enough, this could almost have been chapter 1, because this tells us how Isaiah actually got underway, how he began. It says a commission. In the year that King Uzziah died, which was about 740 BC, so when it says that Isaiah prophesied in the reign of the kings, Uzziah and so on, it was only for about a year or so. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. So in vision, Isaiah, I guess still a fairly young man at this stage, sees God on his throne, high and lifted up. Above it stood seraphim, which in Hebrew means burning ones. These are angels. It could be the cherubim. Appears to be that. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Eternal of Hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And that theme about God's holiness does permeate the book of Isaiah. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. Then I said, oops, woe's me, for I am undone. I've had it, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, you know, the King, the Lord of hosts. And so Isaiah a bit troubled here. I've got a vision, I've seen God on his throne. Maybe this is it. Maybe I'm now finished. That's me out of here, because I'm unclean. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it, and said, behold, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged. Well, I guess Isaiah probably would have been repentant, and no doubt God called him for very good reasons. And here Isaiah just recognized, how can I stand even in vision in the presence of the King, the Lord of hosts? But anyway, he's cleansed by this particular sort of coal. Verse 8, also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? Us, there's more than one. This would be the whom we know as God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. And they're saying, well, we've got a message to send here, but who do you think we could send? Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? Who'll carry our warning message at this time? And I said, Isaiah, here am I. Hey, look, me, send me. And so Isaiah appears to have volunteered. And that would be no surprise. I'm sure that God was very careful in selecting Isaiah with his particular background and his sort of character and so on. But anyway, God says, I wonder who we could send to carry this warning message. Who do you think? Oh, me please. And he said, okay, go and tell this people. Keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and return and be healed. This is the first message that Isaiah has to carry. And I said, well, Lord, how long? And interesting, that passage there, verses 9 and 10 and so on, that's actually quoted 6 times in the New Testament. Keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. That's quoted by Jesus when he is giving parables, and somebody says to him, why are you talking to people in parables? He said, because that's prophesied way back in Isaiah's day. You can tell these people, but they just haven't got the ears to hear. They don't understand. And the reality is actually not so much that God is deliberately concealing in the days of Isaiah, it's the people just are not prepared to listen. They have the ears, they have the eyes, but they just do not want to know. And in a sense, the more Isaiah would prophesy, the more it built up their guilt, because they've got no excuse. They'd heard and heard and heard, but wouldn't listen. They'd seen and seen and seen and seen, but wouldn't pay any attention. And in a sense, you know, Isaiah's prophesy just multiplied their guilt, because they did not want to know. They refused. If you hold your place there, let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 16. It wasn't as if God wasn't trying, but he knew their attitude, and it was fairly predictable in Jeremiah chapter 6, beginning verse 16. Thus says the Eternal, this is God's words, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths where the good way is, and walk in it, and then you'll find rest for your souls. But they said, no, we will not walk in it. So here God said, do this and live. And they said, no, I'm not going to do that. Verse 17 also says God, I set watchmen over you, saying, listen to the sound of the trumpet. So that's the prophet saying, here's a warning. You know, listen to this warning. But they said, we will not listen. We don't want to know. Therefore, hear, O nations, and know, O congregation, what is among them. Hear, O earth, behold, I will certainly bring calamity on this people, even the fruit of their thoughts or plans, because they have not heeded my words, nor my law, but rejected it. So, I mean, God warned, but the people just didn't want to know. They refused. They had zero interest. Look at Zechariah chapter 7. Turn to Zechariah chapter 7. And beginning, I think, it's from about verse 11. Well, actually, verse 8. Zechariah 7 and verse 8. Because Zechariah, another prophet, sent to God's people. It says, "Then the word of the Eternal came to Zechariah, saying, Thus says the Lord of hosts." So here's the word from God to the people. "Execute true justice. Show mercy and compassion, everyone to his brother. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the alien or the poor, and let none of you plant evil in his heart against his brother." In other words, here's God's message, do good. Be good. But what happened? Verse 11, "But they refused to heed, shrugged their shoulders and stopped their ears so that they could not hear. Yes, they made their hearts like flint, refusing to hear the law and the words which the Lord of hosts had sent by his Spirit through their former prophets. And thus great wrath came from the Lord of hosts." So the problem wasn't really that God was being tricky. He sent his messengers, he sent his prophets, he sent his words, but he sent to the people, like it says here, shrugged their shoulders, would not heed, stopped their ears, put their fingers in their ears rather than hear the truth. And in that sense, you know, their guilt was multiplied. Go back to Isaiah, and back there to Isaiah chapter 6. So Isaiah's now got his commission, and he's going to realize that he can take messages and messages and messages over many years. He's going to warn and warn and warn, blow a trumpet, blow a trumpet, blow a trumpet, and yet actually they won't listen. They won't see. They won't hear. He said, verse 11, "Well, how long?" And God answered, "Well, until the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant, and the houses are without a man, and the land is utterly desolate." So until destruction is almost complete. "Until the Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land." So this land, which is currently, you know, fields and orchards and vineyards, farms and industry and houses and a bit like today, is going to be devastated. And it says, verse 13, "But yet a tenth will be in it." Only a tenth will survive. 90% will be killed or removed in captivity. Only one tenth shall remain. And it says, and will return to me for consuming. So even that tenth will be attacked again. "As a terebinth tree or as an oak whose stump remains when it is cut down, so the holy seed shall be its stump." A bit awkward language there, but appears to indicate from the first devastation, destruction, only one tenth will remain. They again will be attacked, but finally only a small amount will be left, like a stump, just a bit left, but enough left to sort of grow again, but not much. And that question about the one tenth, this is one of those passages where we've made the speculation that perhaps in the end time that the nations of American Britain might be reduced to only one tenth. So I think America, the USA, has probably got 300 million people or more, so you might be down to 30 million left. The UK has about 60 million, maybe 6 million left, if the same numbers were to happen again. That's a wee bit of speculation, but you know, it says one tenth. If you look at Amos 5 and verse 3, whilst we're here, Amos, another prophet, prophesied a wee bit earlier in time. So it's Joel and Amos. If you've got to Obadiah, you've gone too far. Amos chapter 5 and verse 3. "Thus says the Lord God," talking of devastation to come, "the city that goes out by 1,000 shall have 100 left." That's a tenth. "That which goes out by 100 shall have 10 left to the house of Israel." So the implication is only one tenth of Israel survive. Well, that may apply in our time. It's speculation, but they might. Certainly what we do know is there'll be great destruction, and it could be as much as 90% or more. Anyway, back we go to Isaiah, picking up now in verse 1 of chapter 7. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Ahaz was the king at this time, and Ahaz was a pretty nasty character, a wicked king, plenty of them, and he's one of them, it's a really nasty sort, but he was king of Judah, and it says at this time that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it, against Jerusalem. So here's war. Like I said, it's not a pleasant time to be around. And here's a war between, from the north, the king of Israel, whose name is Pekah, who's in alliance with Rezin, the king of Syria. And they're both in alliance and attacking Ahaz, king of Judah. So we know a lot of people think that the Jews and Israelites are all the same. You know, they just talk of Jews rather sort of vaguely, like every lives there is a Jew. Well, no, here's an example of where the Israelites, the house of Israel, is fighting and warring against the house of Judah. Because here we have Pekah, king of Israel, warring against Ahaz, king of Judah. So I think we know that. These are two different nations, the house of Israel in the north, house of Judah in the south, and they often were fighting against each other, just like brothers would normally do. And it was told to the house of David, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim, Ephraim being another word for the house of Israel. So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with the wind. In other words, they're a bit frit. Because, hang on a second, the house of Israel is bigger than we are, and they've now, you know, joined up with the Syrians, whose headquarters was Damascus, and they're going to attack us. Oh, my word. So, getting a bit frightened. Then the Eternal said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz. And that's what Isaiah could do, because he had easy access to the city and to the royal family. You and Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. Now, Isaiah has at least two sons we come across. This one's called Shear-Jashub, which means a remnant shall return, and was an important name. And we'll see later that Isaiah's sons were to be signs. So when people saw Isaiah walking along the road after he'd been to the local Burger King, and he got his son holding his hand, he said, oh, there's Isaiah and a remnant shall return, walking together. And it was a message, a remnant shall return, and of course that means the majority are gone. They're dead as dodos or in captivity somewhere, and only a remnant, a small number of the nation is left. That's what the symbol of Shear-Jashub was, that's why it was called that. Anyway, he was told to say to him, verse 4, take heed and be quiet, you know, settle down. You know, we know you're all frightened stiff of this lot to the north, but do not fear or be faint-hearted, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria, and the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against you, saying, so he said, don't be worried about what these guys have planned. You know, be at ease. It doesn't have to happen this way. Because they've said, verse 8, let us go up against Judah and trouble it. Let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. So they were going to basically take over the Jews and put their own man in as king. But thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. Not going to happen. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. He's the king of Syria, and that's actually what he's king of. Within 65 years from this time, Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, that's its capital, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son, Pekah. For some reason, God doesn't seem to like calling Pekah Pekah, just calls him Remaliah's son. So it says there, basically, don't worry about this, Ahaz, because Ephraim is going to be broken in a few years' time. If you will not believe, however, surely you shall not be established. So the message from God is, settle down, put your trust in God, it won't take too long, and Ephraim and Syria will not bother you ever again. They're like two burned out embers, two stubs of smoking firebrands. They can't carry out their plans. But if you do not believe, well, surely you will not be established. And the answer is that Ahaz didn't believe. Ahaz was a wicked, a nasty sort, not such a person you particularly want, and he did not believe, and he paid the penalty. Moreover, the Eternal spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God, ask it either in the depth or the height above. You know, ask me for a sign to prove, to sort of back up what I'm saying, to give you confidence. Ask me any sign, as high as you want, as low as you want. Go on, ask for a sign. Ahaz said, oh, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Which sounds sort of pious, but it wasn't. If God says, test me, God means put me to the test. This is something God's actually commanding. He's saying, look, I want you to put me to the test here. Ask me anything, and I'll do it. Like later on, Hezekiah managed to get the sun to move backwards in the sky, if you remember. You know, God was quite happy. If he actually volunteered to give a test, then he expected people to take the test. But Ahaz was essentially not paying any attention, because Ahaz had some other plans in place. If you hold your place there and look at 2 Kings, chapter 16. 2 Kings, chapter 16, and verse 5. Ahaz heard and heard, but didn't hear, saw and saw, but didn't see. 2 Kings 16, and beginning in verse 5. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. So I've just been reading that. This is what Ahaz does, verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. God had offered to defend and protect, but you see, Ahaz, oh, I'm not going to test God, oh no, oh, I'm too religious for that. I'd already planned what to do. Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who rise up against me. And Ahaz, oops, took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord, in the temple, and in the treasuries of the king's house, and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. And so the king of Assyria heeded him. For the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, that's in Syria, took it, carried his people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. So it wasn't a case of Ahaz being super duper religious and pious and, oh no, no, I wouldn't want to test the Lord my God, oh no. He was just thinking, twerp prophet, I've already sorted things out. Yeah, I've got messengers on the way to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. He's going to come and sort this lot out. He's always had things against Israel and Assyria. He's a good excuse. I'll send him lots of money. In fact, I'll empty the temple of God. Send him some real goodies. And so this guy, he was a nasty sort. No question about that. So we get to back to Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 13. So Isaiah is not very impressed. He says, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Therefore, if you want to ask for a sign, God will give you one anyway. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. Interesting. It says, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now there's clearly two parts to this. There's the present there and then, when some particular young maiden, the term in Hebrew for a virgin can be just a young woman of marriageable age. It refers to the virgin. So there'd be some young woman here that would be known, I think, to Ahaz. Perhaps she was about to get married. The details are not revealed to us, but some young lady who was the virgin was going to quickly conceive and bear a son, and was going to call his name Emmanuel, meaning God with us. Bit of an indictment on a nation that didn't think God was with them, and so on. But of course, there's also the clear extra prophetic part here. This is going to be fulfilled to the letter in a yet future time. Now, if you look at Matthew chapter 1 and verse 18, this is the curious thing about prophecy, it can have a former and a latter application. Not always exactly, but this one definitely does. If you look at Matthew chapter 1 and verse 18. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was as follows. After his mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found a child of the Holy Spirit. So she was a virgin. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not wanting to make her a public example, was minded to put her away secretly. But while he thought about these things, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take to Mary your wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. And she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. So that's a literal fulfillment of the prophecy that Isaiah gave to King Ahaz. Pardon me, if you go back to chapter 7 of Isaiah. But in Isaiah's day, it would be a physical, this was a girl who was at this stage, a virgin, a young maiden. She was going to quickly conceive, bear a son, and going to call his name Emmanuel. That would be a sign to Ahaz. Verse 15, Isaiah 7, Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know how to refuse the evil and choose the good, that would be about maybe 12 years old, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. So the prophecy is, Ahaz, in a few months' time, this person that they know of as the virgin is going to have a son, going to call his name Emmanuel. Before he's 10, 11, 12 years old, Israel to the north and Assyria will not be a problem. But, in case you think that's the end of the story, Ahaz, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house. Days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. Because here's Ahaz thinking, I've got it all sorted out. I've contacted King of Assyria, you know, young Tiglath-Pileser. He's going to be my hero, ride to the rescue. Nope. God says, actually, the king of Assyria is going to come and beat the daylights out of you in a few years' time. And King of Assyria, well, Assyria was not a pleasant nation. It was deemed to be one of the most cruel and barbaric and warlike nations. So if the Assyrians were coming, that was not pleasant. They were quite brutal and very efficient at their warfare. So this would not be good news to say the Assyrians are coming your way. That is the very opposite of good news. Verse 18, it shall come to pass in that day, this could be both then and future, that the Eternal will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest parts of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And really, I think that's just, the fly represents the Egyptians being summoned from the south, and the bee, the Assyrians, being summoned from the north. So Judah, King Ahaz, oh boy, you are in trouble. From the north and from the south, they will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and the clefts of the rocks, and all the thorns and all pastures. In the same day, the Lord will shave with a hired razor, with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and also remove the beard. Well, cutting off men's beards in those days was a sign of humiliation. So these nations from the north, from the Euphrates and the Tigris, where Assyria, you know, lived, from down south, from the, you know, the Nile, the Egyptians, they're going to just humiliate, defeat the people of Judah. In that day, it shall be in that day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. Well, you might think that's okay. Well, not previously you had large farms and pastures with maybe 2,000-3,000 sheep and a couple of thousand goats and so on, but it'll be such devastation that all that's left really is a guy might have a young cow, a couple of sheep. It's really subsistence farming. You know, the pastures and the prosperity is now gone. So it shall be from the abundance of milk they give that he will eat curds. For curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. The 10% who are left will be living off of, you know, honey, you know, natural stuffs that grow on their own, because there'll be no more, you know, large-scale agriculture, gone. It shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it'll just be for briars and thorns. Agriculture is finished. With arrows and bows men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. And to any hill which could be dug with a hole, you'll not go there, for fear of briars and thorns. But it'll become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to roam. You know, no more real orchards, no more vineyards, no more huge crops of goodies, but just a bit of pasture land here and there for a few ox and sheep to roam. Serious destruction. Chapter 8. Moreover, the Eternal said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Good name. And other translations say, take a large tablet, something big, easy to read, that people can see from a long distance, and write on it with a man's pen, or I think other translations say, write on it with simple language, simple characters that are easy to decipher, write on it, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, meaning speed to the spoil, hasten to the booty. So what's that all about? Well, this is just a, I guess, a four-word message that is inscribed in great big, easy-to-read letters, and it really has the meaning, well, it says, you know, speed to the spoil, you know, race to the booty, talking of blitzkrieg warfare. It's a serious warning to the people. It's going to come quickly. Here's a message that says, race to the spoil, hurry to the booty. Verse 2, and I will make for myself faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. And these two guys are going to witness that you wrote this message before it happened. He says, is what he's saying. Don't people saying afterwards, well, yeah, but Isaiah wrote this, you know, after the events, wasn't really a prophecy. He said, no. You write this big. You get up where people can see it from a distance. And I'll get these two guys to be faithful witnesses that this was written in advance. This was real prophecy. Verse 3, then I went to the prophetess, that's his wife, and she conceived and bore a son. And the Eternal said to me, call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Well, okay, all right, God, if that's his name, is Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Bit of a burden to carry that name. I mean, I've heard of the boy named Sue, but this is the longest name in the Bible, I think, personal name in the Bible, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. So his son's called, you know, speed to the spoil, hasten to the booty. That's his name. He's got one son called A Remnant Shall Return, another son called Speed to the Spoil and Hasten to the Booty. So these are quite sort of interesting signs to the people, aren't they? Verse 4, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. So actually, this sign means, yeah, this is fast. This is coming in a hurry. By the time your wife has this little boy, that's obviously going to be probably at least 9 months away, 10 months away, and by the time he's old enough to, or before he's able to say, you know, dad, mum, that's another 10 months, another year, whatever. So essentially, in those couple of years, Damascus and Samaria, the capital of Israel, all the goodies are going to be taken away, the spoil and the booty removed. So this is like fast blitzkrieg. The Eternal also spoke to me, saying, inasmuch as these people refuse the waters of Shiloh that flow softly, and rejoice in Rezin and in Remaliah's son, Pekah, that God doesn't seem to want to name, and now therefore, behold, well actually, the waters of Shiloh are otherwise known to us as the Pool of Siloam, which is in Jerusalem, and apparently it was a gentle, easily flowing fountain. And what God is doing is another picture here. He's saying, well, you could have accepted the gentle, easy, you know, relatively speaking, government of the kings of Judah, just like the slow-moving and relaxing fountains of Siloam, but you prefer to rejoice in Pekah and in Rezin, these kings of the north. Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river Euphrates, strong and mighty, the king of Syria and all his glory. So you've lost out on the gentle waters of Siloam, which are easy and relaxing and quiet, and be replaced by the raging torrent of the mighty Euphrates, meaning these nasty guys from Assyria. It says he will go up over all his channels and go over all his banks. So he's going to actually invade, deluge, and flood Israel in the north. He will even pass through Judah. He will overflow and pass over. He will reach up to the neck. And the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. So Assyria, this cruel, barbaric nation, is going to invade and flood Israel. He will actually move on into Judah. It says he'll reach up to the neck of Judah, but not cover the head, which is Jerusalem. So Judah will be significantly invaded, but won't actually lose the city of Jerusalem. The head stays above the water, obviously. Verse 9. Be shattered, O you peoples, and be broken in pieces. Give ear, all you from far countries. Gird yourselves. You know, prepare all you want. Gird yourselves. But be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves. But be broken in pieces. Take counsel together. But it will come to nothing. Speak the word, you know, to defend. It will not stand. For God is with us. Really, prepare all you want. Says Isaiah, you'll be defeated. You can't stand. For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, do not say a conspiracy concerning all that this people call a conspiracy, nor be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. So he says, essentially, Isaiah, don't join the people. Don't talk about all these conspiracies and all these problems and so on. He said, no, that's not going to happen. The Lord of hosts, him shall you fear. Or hallow, let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. So he's saying to Isaiah, I'm just trying to get the page back that I've inadvertently passed across. It says here, essentially, don't worry about the people. Don't go with them. Rather, verse 13, this is the right choice. The Lord of hosts, him you shall fear. Not the Assyrian. Let him be your dread. Not the Assyrian. Not the Israel of the north. Not the Syrians. And he will be as a sanctuary. Right? So here's a good choice. Here's good information, Isaiah. Don't get carried away with the people. They're panicking. They're fearful. They see conspiracies everywhere. No, no. Isaiah, let God be where you put your fear and your dread. And then he will be a sanctuary to you. Now if you hold a place there, look at Psalms 91. I'm beginning in verse 1. We can see that that's what we do want. We want God as our sanctuary. Isaiah had that choice, and you and I may yet want to have that as our choice. Psalms 91, beginning in verse 1. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. This was the instruction to Isaiah. You know, don't get carried along with the fear of the people. No, no, no. Put your trust in God. Surely, verse 3, He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. So you don't need to be afraid if God is your refuge and your fortress, if we trust in God. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your habitation, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. And that psalm, I think, applies to us today. If we can expect to be delivered from 1,000 dying at one side and 10,000 at the other, and missiles that fly in the night time, if God is our refuge, that's what Isaiah was being told. Look at Psalms 31 and verse 19. Psalms 31 and verse 19. Oh, how great is your goodness, which you have laid up for those who fear you, which you have prepared for those who trust in you in the presence of the sons of men. You shall hide them in the secret place of your presence from the plots or conspiracies of man. You shall keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strife of tongues. So there are indications that you and I can be protected, and should be. And back to Isaiah. So he was told here, you know, very, very sort of plainly, let God be the one you fear, and He will be as a sanctuary. On the other hand, verse 14, but as a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, as a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many among them shall stumble. They shall fall and be broken, be snared and be taken. You see, if you choose God and His way and yield to Him, He will be a sanctuary, a refuge. But if you choose to reject God, to repudiate God, if you choose to lean to your own understanding, then you're going to stumble and fall and be judged. Again, to hold your place there and turn to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. Our choice, isn't it? Really, we choose to, you know, choose life or choose death, choose blessing, choose cursing, choose God's way or choose to reject God's way. Our choice. But 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. Coming to Him, Jesus, as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious, you also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in the Scripture, this is taken from Isaiah, but later chapter, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious. He who believes on Him will by no means be put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, He is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. That's from Isaiah chapter 8. They stumble, being disobedient to the word to which they also were appointed. So you see, the word of God, if you reject it, if you repudiate it, you will stumble. The word that's supposed to give life will cause you to end up, you know, being judged and suffering, and will ultimately, of course, eternal death. So it says here, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense if you are disobedient. So back to Isaiah chapter 8. So that was verse 15, where it says, many among them shall stumble, shall fall and be broken, be snared and taken. Verse 16, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. I guess applying at that time to Isaiah, making sure that his warning messages were properly secured for posterity. And of course, we've got them today, so nobody did that. Prophetically, it could also mean that, if you like, God's testimony and God's law, the scriptures as a whole, will be sealed up by the disciples of Jesus. So your Matthews and the Marks and the Lukes and the Johns and Pauls and so on, they are the ones who finally sealed completely the scriptures. Nothing came after their time. Verse 17, I will wait on the Lord who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. See, no matter how bad it gets, these barbaric military men from Assyria invading Israel to the north and down into Judah, Isaiah says, I will hope, I'll have confident expectation in him. Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel. Well, Isaiah and Maher Shalal Hashbaz and Shear Jashub, that's him and the children whom the Lord has given him. And every time you would look out your window and you see Isaiah walking down the road, or perhaps on his bike, behind him is his first son, you know, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, waving to you, and you think, oh, there's speed to the spoil and there's a race to the booty. Oh, right behind him is Shear Jashub, or a remnant shall return. If you see these guys, Isaiah and these two boys, well, you've got a warning. Every time you saw them, a warning, a warning, a warning. Speedy blitzkrieg to the spoil, and only a remnant will be left. So like he says here, we are signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. When they say to you, seek those who are mediums and wizards, who whisper and mutter, should not a people seek their God? Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? When things get really bad, the invasion is imminent, there's destruction in the north of the land, and you know, messengers running down with all the tales of war and destruction, people under panic think, who do we find to sort of tell us what's going to happen? Astrologers, you know, and mediums and spiritists, and the word is no, you don't go to the dead to seek knowledge. It says, verse 20, to the law and to the testimony. That's where you get the truth. That's what Isaiah has been telling them. To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. And that applies absolutely to our day today. There are people, plenty of people today, that, you know, read their horoscope and go and get their fortune told. And even, you know, presidents have been known to seek advice from the other side. And I believe Mr. Hitler and people like that were heavily into the occult, looking for information, looking for knowledge, looking for secrets to use to, you know, hold men in their sway. But no, to the law and to the testimony, and for you and I as well, anything that we are being told or hear, especially things from, you know, ministers and teachers of the word, well, don't just listen, don't just nod, you know, idly and carelessly accept what's being said. To the law, to the testimony, like the Bereans, check these things out daily, whether or not they are so. So says Isaiah, to the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them, and they will pass through it hard pressed and hungry. And it shall happen when they are hungry that they will be enraged and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom of anguish, and will be driven into darkness. So when the devastation comes, they'll curse God, blame him, and they'll curse their king, of course, who brought it about, and they'll look up, and they'll look down, just gloom, and darkness, and devastation, and destruction. Sounds pretty gloomy. thankfully, chapter 9 brings us to some very good news. But of course, that's not for today because we've now run out of time. So I think with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.